And now you are, as usual, on a Friday afternoon at this time, up to date. Hi, everybody. It's time for Spectrum West, Art, Culture, and Humanities of West Wisconsin. I'm Al Ross. Today we'll learn more about a 125-year-old tradition in Menominee, the Ludington Guard Band. Jim Oliver chats with Mike Cook about Seussical opening next week from the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild. And Jim will present what's on stage at West Wisconsin theater venues as well. There are new full-ride undergraduate string student scholarships available at UW-Eau Claire. Nobuyoshi Nobu, for short, Yasuda, is here with those details. Plus, author B.J. Hollers stopped by to talk with me about his new publications. But if you will, allow me a moment to vent a bit. You know, I'm amazed I was even able to physically throw together a show this week. I am in the process of moving. Not long distance, just a few miles. Even after purging a lot, I still have several loads of boxes yet to make the trip. Moving really does zap one's energy. If you've moved recently, you're with me. I swear I will not move again for a very long
time. Dean, how are you?
I'm good. What's Dean, up in your
Dean
life?
Dean Kallenbeck is here. Yeah?
Oh, hi.
You know what? If I never move again, it's a four-letter word that I am...
Well, I got some news for you, Al.
What?
Spectrum West is moving.
Spectrum
no, we
West
don't need
moving.
To pack up the boxes. You're just moving times.
Oh,
we're not
thanks.
Changing from Western Wisconsin.
Yeah, I was picturing myself.
We're going to move to Thursday mornings, 10 o'clock, from 10 to 11.
So I have to get up?
You do. But the idea is there's a lot more people listening to the radio at 10 o'clock in the morning on Thursdays. So we're going to get an opportunity
really?
To talk to them.
All right. Well, I can handle that.
Yeah. And for the people who are used to the Friday night thing, we're going to make Spectrum West available also Friday nights at 7 on 89.7 WUEC and 90.7 WVSS, our news and classical music network stations here in western Wisconsin.
What time again?
7 o'clock.
7 o'clock.
On Friday night, 10 o'clock Thursday morning on this station you're used to listening to Spectrum West on, 88.3 WHWC or 88.7 WRFW.
Oh, so the Friday night people just have to wait a couple more hours. They could have their fish. And then...
Yeah, eat the fish first before instead of doing it before you go to fish.
So let's see. Spectrum West is moving from Fridays to Thursday morning at 10. And for the people who like it on Fridays, it'll be aired on the News and Classical Music Network at 7 Friday evening.
Yeah.
But no boxes.
No boxes.
You sure?
Well.
Well, see, I'm not sure I like that last response. It doesn't offer much of a guarantee, does it? Okay, so we start the show with breaking news, but let's get on to today's chapter at 9 minutes after 5. Engaging is a way of describing our first guest, B.J. Hollers, the English professor, and today B.J. Hollers, the author. He recently released a couple of follow-ups to his absorbing historical piece, 13 Loops, Race, Violence, and the Last Lynching in America. One is another historical piece called Opening the Doors, the Desegregation of the University of Alabama, and the Fight for Civil Rights in Tuscaloosa. And the other pulls a 180 as a volume of stories. It's called Sightings. It's the one he dropped off for me, and we'll get to it in a moment. But first, a bit about Opening Doors with B.J. Hollers.
In short, it's about the infamous scene of George Wallace standing in the schoolhouse door on June 11, 1963, and blocking two highly qualified African-American students from entering that school.
Tell me about your interest in this kind of stuff.
If you asked me, you know, 6-7 years ago, would I be writing books about race in the South, I would have... told you no way. You know, I've been writing fiction up till that point, but I spent 4 years at the University of Alabama in grad school. As I saw my time coming to an end there, I thought I really don't want to leave this place without trying to embrace some of the stories and tackle some of the harder stories. And so I was really proud to have left with two books about that place. It meant a lot to me, so I hope I could touch upon it at least a little bit before I say goodbye.
Tell me now the research that went into Opening the Doors. A tough deal?
It was not as tough as the first book. 13 Loops, of course, is about this horrific lynching that took place in 1981, and having to research that was even harder. This book was a little more removed. A lot of it's about 1956, 1963, 1964. And so what made it really fun is it all takes place in the town I was living in, Tuscaloosa, Alabama, so I could ride my bicycle over to people's barbershops and houses and knock on their door and just really kind of see them, you know, 50 years after the experience and learn from their experiences.
I didn't have this in my preparation, but as you spoke, I thought to myself, I better ask him his purpose for writing this. Are you writing these as reminders for next generations of what went on? And, I mean, you weren't around in those days, but
you
it must make you feel as if you were.
I mean, I often tell people I read the newspaper for 1963 the way most people read the newspaper for today, you know. Okay. So I could tell you all about the movies that were playing in June of 1963.
Well, you got to go to the grocery ads and see how cheap everything
was. Oh, and the gas, all of that. I know, it makes me miss it, but that's about all. But, you know, I think I was inspired to write these stories, and in particular the Opening the Doors book, because I was teaching an African-American literature class at the university,
and I remember that.
I mentioned to my students, you know, hey, have you all heard about George Wallace's Stay in the Schoolhouse Door? And there were a couple of shrugs, and no one really knew the whole story. And I'd lived there for 3 years, and I didn't know the whole story either. And I thought, you know, I got one more year here. I'm not going to leave this place behind until I try to get to the bottom of it the best I can.
It was important stuff, and I think what happens most when young people who weren't around during those days hear what went on, they can't believe it.
Right, and that's what was so strange for my students, too. They couldn't believe that, you know, their grandparents, in some cases their parents, were the same ones struggling to get into this school.
Yeah. All right. Well, by writing Sightings, you have revealed to me a writer of many dimensions, because now it's nothing like your other historical offerings, which we've been speaking of. It's a potpourri of fun fabrication as well as a combination of fantasy and fact, taken, I'm guessing now, from people you've known and actual occurrences in your life. Is that right or wrong?
Yeah, I would say there's certainly a lot of composite figures in here. I wouldn't claim myself as any one character, but I often get asked, you know, is your dad a reenactor? Because a lot of my stories feature sort of a bumbling father who reenacts this, that, and the other. And so, you know, you could probably recognize some of the people you see in here.
Okay, before we go on, though, let's make sure that people understand what Sightings is. It's a compilation of stories, some short, some longer. The impetus behind this book. Did you need a break from the heavy stuff?
Yeah, actually. And I often tell people when I was writing 13 Loops, I wrote that by day, and then by night I would try to take a break and get a breather and try to write something a bit more fun-loving, something that could allow me to actually enjoy the process a little bit more instead of kind of working in the trenches. And so this was in many ways a relief for me. It was something sort of necessary for my soul to write these stories. And I've been writing coming-of-age stories for a while. I've always been very interested in the coming-of-age story, kind of subverting it in new and unique ways. And so, this is how I spent the final years of my own coming-of-age.
B.J. Hollers is with us here on Spectrum West. He's an assistant professor of English at UW-Eau Claire. We've spoken with him about 13 Loops, his book about race violence and the last lynching in America. He's also written Opening the Doors, The Desegregation of the University of Alabama and the Fight for Civil Rights in Tuscaloosa. We are speaking today specifically about Sightings, stories. You know, if what we talk about the book doesn't spur you to buy it, go look at the cover. It has a big hand holding a basketball. Now, in this book, BJ, there's a story about the experience of living in a neighborhood in transition. Native American family moves in. You said coming of age, and I wrote that down. I guess I was trying to define what this book felt like, and I wasn't able to come up with coming of age, but yes, it is.
I like to think so. And as one person recently pointed out to me, as the stories progress, it starts out kind of goofy, and then by the end, it gets terribly dark. And I think it sort of progresses in a coming of age fashion itself in some ways. I like to think that at least.
You also talk about Sasquatch, who stars on a high school basketball team. You talk about Hitler as an artist, a dad, as you already alluded, who really loves history. I put in parentheses, I think we've all known one like him at one time or another.
If we're lucky, we have.
Yes. So you've sort of touched on it, but these stories are so descriptive. Where do they come from? How do you come up with what's in them?
Yeah, and it's so hard to try to trace a story back to its origin. I suppose just thinking back to the first story you mentioned, Indian Village, there's a small neighborhood in Fort Wayne, Indiana, which is my hometown. It's where most of the stories are set, and it's called Indian Village. And they actually have teepees, you know, in the neighborhood, and it's kind of this pristine, kids always riding their bike to the baseball diamond and to the pool, and sort of this perfect look of summer, you know, in this one neighborhood. So I really wanted to try to live there a bit, and never did in real life, but I really wanted to live there in the story form. So I suppose I spent some time cruising around there till I tried to figure out what might have been taking place there. Mm-hmm.
I can see what the intention of writing your other books, 13 Loops and Opening the Doors, is. What's your intention for writing Sightings? Mainly just a let's have fun book or let's enjoy reading book?
I mean, that's good enough for me. I hope people do enjoy reading it. But at the same time, I guess an argument that might be able to be made from the book would be, you know, there's a lot of cliches with coming of age stories. You know, there's just a you know, an entire treasure trove of marketing value in terms of how we sell things to young people in movies and TV shows, how we consume it all. So I think it often gets caught up in cliche and it gets sort of a bad rap. So I really worked hard to try to make the coming of age story a bit unique by throwing in a Sasquatch or a family of clowns every once in a while.
Here's something I noticed that I have to ask you about. You capitalized the word dumpster.
Oh my gosh. Is
that a brand name?
Let me tell you, this was a mind-boggling thing. I'm so glad you brought it up. In the 13 Loops book, the same thing. You'll realize the word dumpster's in both of these books.
Oh,
and
okay.
It's capitalized there too. One day after that book was going to press, I woke up in the middle of the night and thought, wait a minute, why is that capitalized? Why did the editor change it to a capital letter? And I emailed them frantically, and sure enough, it's a trademark thing, just like Kleenex. That's what they told me. And the copy editors change it every time I use that word. So that I guess put me at ease, though I still am a bit disconcerted by it. I can't imagine that being the case, but he promised me.
Generically, it would be called, what, a large
receptacle, refuse bin. There you go.
So yeah. Dumpster is, I should capitalize.
That's what they tell me. Don't
ask. Does anybody get royalties every time you say the word dumpster?
They're probably making more off the book than I am if they are.
Yeah. The way you wrote, and this was the fun part I was talking about, the way Schooners was written, you can, if you read it right, actually hear the voice of this person talking. This person writing this story, this person is a motor mouth.
Yes, he is. Yes, he
is. Just can't stop yakking.
You trying to imply something about me here?
I don't know.
No, his name's Roger Silverstein. He's a young boy, and he sort of has some kind of emotional needs, emotional damage perhaps, and he's really struggling to get to the bottom of a missing neighbor girl in his neighborhood, and yet he can't quite grasp the situation, and so he's really struggling to find a way to do that. And so that's sort of what that story is about, a young person who's desperate to get to the bottom of something you just can't understand by just blathering on and on.
Yeah, and the way it's written, though, and so I did this, and then I said to me, and so I think to myself, as a writer, that had to be a story that you had to write in one sitting, because I can't imagine writing that pace and then going to bed and getting up the next day and trying to pick up the same pace.
Well, it's funny, and that story and a couple of the stories, Westward Expansion, a few others, I actually wrote the story, then expanded them into a novel, and then broke them back down to the initial story. And it was just a way, I guess, to really, well, I'd like them all to be novels, but since that didn't quite work out, it was a way to kind of understand the voice more fully. And so the version that you read in this book, it's actually, 200 pages long, but you get the 10 pages that it all kind of became distilled into. And that's sometimes all you get out of a novel, 10 good pages. And so that's sort of the price you pay.
And I have to admit to you that I have not had time to finish the book, but I think you can tell that I've read at least a good part of it. And, the sign of a good book is the fact that I look forward to finishing it.
That's great.
People also have to realize I'm not a literary critic by any stretch of any imagination, but for what it's worth, I do recommend Sightings to anyone looking to enjoy reading on a level that's like playing hide-and-seek when you were young. It feels like a game, but there's the intrigue of never really knowing what's around the next corner. So what's next for B.J. Hollers? I read something about doing something about the area now that you live in.
Yeah, and I think that's maybe kind of how it works. When I lived in Alabama, I was writing the Alabama books. Mm-hmm. Now that I'm here, I'm sort of embracing, what we have here. And, of course, we have a wonderland of nature all around us. The rivers, I suppose there's no other way of putting it. And there's something wonderful and beautiful about them, but also something very dangerous and scary about them. And so as a relatively new father and someone who, likes to take his kid to the lakes and the rivers, at least to look at them or splash around a bit, I've become very, very entranced, I suppose, by the rivers. And so, yeah, I've been writing quite a bit about some of the more difficult things that have occurred in them, primarily drownings, especially in the years between 1880 and 1920 or so.
So how long does it take for B.J. Hollers to live in a place before he decides there's enough to write about?
That's a good question. I certainly don't think I'm an expert on Eau Claire or the rivers by any stretch, but I certainly didn't feel that way about the Alabama books either. But I suppose more than anything, it gives me the opportunity to really embrace a place and live fully in it and try to go to places I normally wouldn't go and talk to people I might not normally talk to, and to really feel like I'm a part of a place, I like to try to write about it. So it's my way of trying to introduce myself to my place, I suppose.
Author and assistant professor at UW Eau Claire, B.J. Hollers. The book is called Sightings, Stories. Read it. You'll like it. B.J., thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Al.
B.J. Hollers, Hollars. The book is available online at Amazon, at the local store in Eau Claire, at the Volume 1 World headquarters, and at various independent bookstores. B.J. makes periodic appearances. Here's one for a few pages forward on your calendar. He'll be reading as part of the Chippewa Valley Book Festival at the Menominee Library way off in October, Wednesday, October 16th. 521, this is Spectrum West. Love it that you're here with us. Support for WPR comes from Visit Winona, where lake and river water trails provide the opportunity to glide, paddle, and drift through the summer. Visit Winona.com. This is the year to discover Winona's outdoors.
Support also comes from Festival Foods, dedicated to making grocery shopping easier for all shoppers with the introduction of pink, yellow, and green boomerang buy tags throughout the store. Festival Foods, a Wisconsin-grown company.
Tuesday Night Blues from the Chippewa Valley Blues Society presents Code Blue with Katya and Sue next Tuesday the 25th. Owen Park Banjo in Eau Claire. Again this summer, the Chill on the Hill Summer Concert Series at UW River Falls, 7 p.m. next Tuesday the 25th. It's Matthew Santos, plays piano rock, and Takanobu, modern cello. Well, Spectrum West would be far from complete without the news about West Wisconsin Theater. Here's Jim Oliver with another update.
Musical, the Musical is a musical by Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty, and it's based on the books of Dr. Seuss. The show debuted on Broadway in the year 2000. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild will present Seussical, the Musical, opening next Thursday, June 27th, and running through Sunday, June the 30th, at the State Theater in Eau Claire. Joining us is the director of the production, Mike Cook. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Well, Seussical the Musical is based on several of the Dr. Seuss books, so explain to me how the playwrights managed to pull all those sources into one meaningful musical play.
Well, there was a lot of material to choose from, but what they finally decided was the plot lines that would sustain themselves over a longer period of time to, you know, put together a show would be the Horton Hears a Who and Horton Hatches an Egg. And that's the elephant who hears the tiny little planet of Who floating in the sky. And then, of course, in the other book, he finds an abandoned egg who belongs to Maisie, the bird, and he hatches the egg for Maisie. And they put those two together and they kind of mash it together. And they said, we can't do it without the Cat in the Hat. Absolutely have to have the Cat in the Hat. So the Cat in the Hat becomes the narrator. And there are other characters that are from those books and a few others thrown in. The Grinch is in there. He does the yearly Christmas pageant for the people of Whoville. He tells his own story. It's sort of a humorous thing. And characters do pop up that you've heard before. But the basic bare bones plot comes from Horton Hears a Who and Horton Hatches an Egg.
Now, is this a kid show or are adults going to like it as well?
Well, just like Dr. Seuss, it's written for kids, but that sneaky old guy, he used to throw in social commentary every now and again. And the other thing we're doing is there's a lot of humor in this show. There's humor for kids, but there's also humor for adults. So two levels there. The kids will laugh at some things, and the adults will chuckle knowingly at other things. And I think it matches up real nicely for all ages.
Well, who are the principal actors in the show?
Well, the Cat in the Hat is played by Nathan Libby. And Horton is played by Greg Kernkamp. And there's a lot of other really talented people that come in right below in the major supporting areas. Carly Preissner is Gertrude, Horton's love interest, although he doesn't know it. Jojo the Kid is the Cat in the Hat's sidekick. He gets her into all sorts of troubles. And that's Marley Anderson. We've just got a whole bunch of really talented people in a lot of big and small roles.
It occurred to me as you were talking there, what about costuming? This must be take some creative costuming to do this.
Yes, it is. You take the source material. Once again, you look at the books and you look at what wild outfits that the illustrators came up with in the Dr. Seuss books. So I handed it over to my costume designer, Barb Weisenberger, who assembled a crew of like 7 or 9 people.
Wow.
And they've been busy sewing and coming up with all kinds of odd things. I took a look at some of them last night, and it's like, okay. But no, it's exactly what you'd think when you would open a Dr. Seuss book, the yellows and the blues and the reds and all these odd colors put together into costumes. It's really, really nice looking. And it's the same thing with the set. Oh, it's a set by conglomeration. We really don't have a set director. I've helped design part of it, and Sessions at the Theater Guild helped design part of it. Her husband, Bob, helped design part of it. What's going to happen with that is, with all the different weird designs that Dr. Seuss has, it's all going to come together in a way that doesn't necessarily fit like blocks would fit together, but in a way that the universe of Dr. Seuss would fit together. That weird-looking goofy tree over there, that fits in with that weird-looking platform over there. That's how we're doing that.
He is Mike Cook, who is director of the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of Seussical the Musical. Well, I assume you have a musical director and a choreographer.
Meg Gazella is our vocal director. Meg's first try at vocal director, and she's doing one heck of a good job, because this is not just a musical. When you think of musical, you think a song, some dialogue, a song, some dialogue. This is more of an operetta, 95% singing.
Oh, really?
Yes, okay. And just, you know, with a few verses of Dr. Seuss thrown in between the songs. Mm-hmm. So Meg's job, she's been tackling it and doing a fine, fine job of 2 hours of straight music.
Ooh.
And our choreographer is Josh Thomas Murray, who's done several shows as a choreographer, and he's got some clever things for everybody to do. By clever, I mean things that will keep kids entertained as well as adults entertained at the same time.
How about Pit Orchestra and that sort
of thing? Pit Orchestra, Teresa Soles, who has just been named the orchestra director at North High School. We were at orchestra rehearsal this last Sunday, and those guys are really kicking it. They're really, really good. I think the cast was surprised. Oh, well, we got to step it up a little bit here. and I think it's all going to come together really, really nicely.
Well, great. Well, you know, you've been in a few times, and I've never gotten around to asking you about how you got into this situation where you've been bitten by this bug of theater and acting and directing and all that other stuff.
Well, when I was at Ford's Theater with Lincoln that day,
No.
The bug bit me in high school. I was originally a tech guy, and before I graduated from high school, my drama teacher said, "We've got to get you on stage." And I'm like, no. Hmm. Well, she cast me in a show against my will, and I went out there, and the first time I heard applause and laughter, that's it. And I've been doing it now for 4 years.
Somewhere I read 3 decades. Is that a fairly conservative estimate?
Yeah, that's a conservative estimate, yeah.
Now, you do a lot at Fannie Hill. I know that.
Yes, I've been there for quite a while.
Yeah. How do you make a living then, or how have you made a living over the years? Because I know a little bit about what theatrical people get paid, and it ain't much. So
that's true. Well, you know, it's enough that I would call it a part-time job. Mm-hmm. And I think for most people, especially people who would live in this area of the country and not in L.A. or Chicago or New York, that's all it really can be, because the opportunities are not always there. And I try to mix theater and film, do a little bit of both. It's a good part-time job. Mm-hmm. That's the best I can say. And it keeps me going, keeps my creative juices flowing, and a little bit of money on the side. That's a good thing, too. But I would think that most people who are in my position around here would agree with me that you've got to have something else to fall back on. And with my wife, we own a copywriting company. We write radio commercials.
Now, you got started in radio many, many years ago, apparently.
Yes. 1970, I started in radio, and I spent 23 years in the business, disc jockey, you name it. That was a career, and here I am on the radio right now, but I remember the day when I opened up the microphone, and I didn't have anything to say, and I just shut the microphone off. I thought, better get out now. I've got nothing left to say.
I thought radio guys never ran out of
Well, see, that's the thing. I was like, if I got nothing to say now, what's going to happen in 5 years?
Just as a sidelight, I can remember going to news conferences as a newspaper man and having to sit there and listen to the radio guys drowned out the person who we were really interested in hearing. So that's why I questioned whether they ever ran out of things to say. One last question about, you've done a lot of acting and a lot of directing. Do you have a preference?
Two different skill sets. Over the last year, I've directed 4 shows for various companies. I've been in a couple. Directing, I think, is harder because there's more coordination involved. When you're an actor, you can spend more time on yourself and your character and how it fits into the scheme of things. Whereas when you're a director, you've got to look at the overall picture. I enjoy doing both, but I also like mixing it up, because if you did all one, it would get either boring or tired. Hasn't happened to me yet because I've been able to mix it up. I don't know if I really have a preference. I like doing both, and I like to mix it up.
Have you ever directed yourself in a show?
I've made some appearances in shows that I've directed. A lot of the time, it's because someone's sick at the last minute or things like that. You step mm-hmm. in. I don't particularly like doing that because, as a director, you like to watch and see things develop. Mm-hmm. And if you see a problem developing, maybe you can correct it. If you're on stage, you might be the problem that needs correcting. it's a necessary evil sometimes. And I think anybody in town who directs will say that they've had to step in from time to time for whatever reason. I'd rather not. But in Seussical, You'll see me on stage for about 10 seconds. There's a reason for it. There's a part that needed to be filled, and for the 10 seconds that needed to be filled, I thought, well, I'll just step in and do it.
We'll look forward to seeing you on stage again then. We've been visiting with Mike Cook, who is director of the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of Seussical the Musical, a musical play based on the books of Dr. Seuss. The show opens next Thursday, June the 27th, and runs through Sunday, June 30th, at the State Theater in Eau Claire. For ticket information, you can call 715-832-PLAY. Mike Cook, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, sir.
Spectrum West for a Friday, the 21st day of June, longest day. Are you feeling it? And also not thinking about the fact that the days start getting shorter. Soon. No, not soon. No. Well, let's see. Soon, yes, but I mean it won't be dark soon or early soon. Man, paint myself in a corner. More than 70 works of art by UW Stout students are on display throughout the summer at the Furlong Gallery in Menominee. The summer events program from UW Eau Claire features a performance by Boiled in Lead, 7 p.m. Monday, in the Owen Park Band Shell. Concerts continue through July 29th. Tonight, it's comedian C. Willie Miles at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee, 7:30 showtime. Tomorrow night, Vicki Emerson performs songs from her latest CD, Dust and Echoes. Well, the prospect of continuing to welcome many of the most promising young string musicians got a boost recently when the Eileen Phillips Cohen String Scholarship was announced. 4 such scholarships will be awarded each year. Will also result in a premier string quartet consisting of scholarship winners. Nobuyoshi Yasuda, Nobu for short, conductor of the University Symphony, also music director of the Chippewa Valley Symphony, is with us. He recently joined me in the studio to talk about the award and what it all means. This is a big deal. Let's go back to the beginning of it. How did this scholarship get underway?
You know, Eileen has been, you know, a supporter, big supporter of, you know, the university orchestra. You know, so then she actually used to play in the orchestra. And okay. I remember, you know, when I came here in 1991, and then she actually called me one day, and then she asked me, so if I can, you know, I'm Eileen Cohen, and then, you know, I'm a supporter of the orchestra program. And I said, oh, thank you very much. And so then I think I met her, and then she basically told me that, is it okay, you know, if I, you know, play in the university orchestra? No, I said, oh, no problem, of course, you know, please come. And so I don't know how many years, but she played in the university orchestra, you know, for several, you know, years. So that was basically the kind of history. And she has an incredible, like, a love for music. And, you know, so then suddenly she called me. It was last February. So I think this is the time, you know, I would like to help, you know, the university orchestra, you know, in a little bit bigger way. Please tell me what you want. So basically, you know, what I did was that I mean, kind of told her that how difficult it is to recruit students, you know, these days. And so then, can I tell you my dream situation? And she's like, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, right.
So then basically I told her that, you know, if we could have full ride scholarship for string quartet, 2 violins and 1 viola and 1 cello. I'm not just saying just an okay string quartet. It's mm-hmm. I said, you know, with the incredible high caliber string quartet.
Mm-hmm.
So then she's like, yes, that's great. Sounds great. So then she said, okay, I will talk to, you know, my family, and then so I will get back to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was already 2 days later.
Wow.
She said, okay, I really like this, your idea, and I would like to support the full ride. Boom, like that. So I just couldn't believe. I mean, I didn't really do anything. I just basically, for these 22 years, you know, I just, I have been enjoying, you know, I mean, you know, developing the programs. Actually, of course, it's not just me. You know, my students really work so hard, and also my colleagues at, you know, Department of Music. I mean, without their efforts, I mean, we cannot do anything. But at the same time, you know, this kind of a huge financial support to recruit high-caliber students will really make a huge difference.
The quartet, you would recruit freshmen.
Freshmen, yeah.
As string players.
Mm-hmm.
then they would participate in this quartet for the 4 years that they go to school?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
And then you'd have a whole new quartet?
We actually kind of gradually recruit. So probably we might not have a whole quartet, I mean the members, the coming year. For example, probably in 2 years or maybe after next year, we're going to have a string quartet. After even this scholarship was announced, we are already hearing many things from people. Wow, you guys have this incredible scholarship. And so could you tell us about this one? So now it's word is out. So I'm sure that during the next year, many high caliber students will contact us, and then so we will have some quartet, possibly even next year, or I mean for sure after next year. But the significance about this quartet is that usually this kind of a fluoride scholarship exists in a graduate level. But I never seen anything like this in an undergraduate level.
Okay.
So that's why this makes an incredible, I don't know, how can I say that? It's a very, very big deal. Yeah.
So what's the process? Let's say someone out there is listening and they're quite the string player. How do they find out more about the scholarship?
Of course, they can find that information, if they know about it. I mean, of course, they can come to our website and they can find it. But, we have an audition process. Actually, it's okay. Clearly actually stated in the website. So they have to prepare a certain repertoire. And so they have to send those recording actually on a DVD. Or sometimes these days, actually, you can submit on a YouTube or,
sure.
Those kind of things. We want to make sure that we actually can see them, how they play. So then we will have actually live audition.
Nobuyoshi Yasuda, Violin Orchestra String Ensemble, is what he mentors at UW-Eau Claire. And we're talking about the Eileen Phillips Cohen String Scholarship. Tell me about Nobu, the first recipient. Tell me about Caitlin Witherspoon.
We were very lucky, actually. She came to UW-Eau Claire to study with us 2 years ago, and then she's incredibly talented. So then
she's a cello player.
She's a cello player. She's not just a talented cellist, but it's incredible. I mean, she's incredibly focused. I mean, always she has the energy and focus, and she's an incredible learner. I mean, she's so smart, and then she just learned so many things quickly. So, I mean, that was one thing we immediately noticed, from her. And then also her seriousness about whatever she does, it's really given me inspiration, too, to teach.
Mm-hmm.
And she's been already a principal, cello player in the university orchestra, and she's already serving as a great leader. Suddenly, this huge scholarship became available. Boom! What came to my mind was that, wow, Caitlin. Then I asked the foundation, UW Foundation, and can we, award this scholarship to current student? And they asked me, so do you have somebody really in this caliber?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we have a perfect person.
More young people play band instruments than they do strings. Is that true?
I think so, because, teaching strings actually is very difficult, especially in the public school system, to maintain the strings, instruments are very costly too, I think. The very beginning stage of learning a string instrument is very difficult. I mean, in a way, frustrating, because to get the recent sound or get the actual pitch itself from the string instrument is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that, playing a wind instrument is easier or anything like that. I mean, of course, they have their own challenge. Yeah. However, when you pick up the instrument and then... For winds, you have a certain kind of fingerings already set for mm-hmm. certain, mm-hmm. Notes. And then, of course, the string instruments, we have also fingerings too.
Yeah.
But fingering doesn't really help unless you really hear the pitch in your mind and you place your fingers on the right spot. Then it's very difficult to really develop the kind of a certain level, which you can actually, enjoy mm-hmm. playing music.
Now, you've been teaching for 22 years at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. What has changed over those 22 years? Is the commitment of young people the same, especially music students? Young people have changed because their environment has changed, their challenges have changed?
I mean, overall, actually, I have to say that I see less kind of imagination. However, if you lead them to use their imagination and work hard to perform music, and, you know, at a very high level, I mean, they still do that. I don't think the quality of students, I don't think, you know, has changed. However, you know, like 20 years ago, we didn't have iPhone.
Right.
We didn't have text message, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have that kind of a convenient, actually, kind of website, you know, to visit.
Right.
20 years ago, everybody, I mean, it's not just students. We had to use our imagination to do something.
And you had to work hard to get information.
Right. Even getting the information, we had to work. But now, you know, everybody can get any information so easily. And also now they expect information comes to them in a way, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So then sometimes, you know, I ask them, so what do you want to do? And the first kind of reaction is like, I don't know. Or sometimes, I don't care. What do you mean you don't care? And they're like, oh, no, I don't mean that. But I'm very sensitive to those words. Like, I don't care or I don't know. I
mean,
like, you know, I don't want them to use those words, you know, too easily. You know, saying I don't care, I don't know, it already became their kind of reflex.
There's shortcuts.
That's why music is important. Mm. Music does not have any kind of an answer, basically, correct or wrong. We have a lot of different ways.
And no shortcuts.
No shortcuts. To improve your playing skill, you still have to practice.
Yes.
You need a discipline. And then to play in an orchestra or a band or a choir, you need also discipline as a team. And also you need imagination to be expressive. All of these things, I mean, the music is the way to really cultivate their imagination and discipline and focus.
And the other thing you need is you have to want to express yourself.
That's the one thing, since you asked me if the change, I mean, students' actual quality has changed, I have to say that now...
I think I used the word commitment.
Commitment, probably it's still the same, but now we have to somehow lead them to make commitment. Quite often, they don't know what they want.
They know what they like. They may not know what they want.
Yeah, there is a difference, right?
Yeah.
What they like and what they need to do. Why I'm still excited about, you know, my life is that because I'm so curious about so many things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not just a musician. I mean, I'm curious about so many things. I'm curious. I want to learn more about this.
Yeah.
Then I just kind of, I become, you know, very active to learn something. So that becomes my joy of learning. So, I mean, my message actually to my students, you know, if you don't know, it's okay. But I want you to be curious.
Yeah.
And I want you to learn something. And once you have this kind of a habit of, okay, I'm curious. I'm going to learn something. And you discover something. It's a joy.
Yeah. The joy of being curious is the journey satisfying that curiosity.
Yes.
And the journey used to be a longer journey years ago.
Right.
Now you can satisfy curiosity at the, you know, at the snap of a finger.
Right. Probably that's why I use music to actually explore so many different possibilities.
Yeah.
You can do this way. You can do that way. And let's try this way today.
Mm-hmm.
Let's try this way, you know, tomorrow. Why you don't tell us the one way? No. Music is not like that. I want you to know that music can be any way, many different ways.
It's always fascinating talking to you. Nobu, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me.
That's fun. Because of time, by the way, I had to cut a segment in which I asked Nobu about the difference between a symphony and a philharmonic. I think I might share that brief discussion on a future program. Remember, as of July 11th, we'll be on at 10 a.m. Thursdays on this Ideas Network station, with a 7 p.m. reprise on Fridays on the news and classical music stations of 89.7 and 90.7. Here's what's coming up this weekend and beyond in Western Wisconsin theater venues. The Wizard of Oz will be presented by the Northern Star Theater in Rice Lake tonight and Sunday, and next Thursday through Sunday. There are no Saturday performances. The St. Croix Art Barn in Osceola will present Mothers of the Bride tonight and Saturday. Over the Tavern opened this week at the Red Barn Theater in Rice Lake. The show runs through June 29th. The Eau Claire Children's Theater production of Finnegan's Farewell plays tonight and Saturday at the Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. The Children's Theater will also present Disney's The Sleeping Beauty, June 27th and 28th at the Oxford.
Crazy for You will play Saturday and Sunday and next Thursday through Sunday at the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls. The show will run through August 18th. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of Seussical the Musical opens Thursday, June 27th, and runs through Sunday, June 30th, at the State Theater in Eau Claire. Peter Pan and Tink will play at 10 a.m. Thursday at the Old Gem Theater in New Richmond. The show will play for groups through August 2nd. The St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson will present Always Patsy Cline tonight and Saturday. The show will run Fridays and Saturdays through August 10th. And Don't Dress for Dinner will play weekends and selected weekdays at Fanny Hill Dinner Theater in Eau Claire. The show runs through June 30th. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. I'm Jim Oliver.
Here's a Spectrum memo for you. Volume 1 again presents the Sounds Like Summer concert series at Phoenix Park in downtown Eau Claire. Next Thursday, the 27th, Michael Perry and the Long Beds, Adeline Rose and Scrimbo, First Notes. Scheduled drift across the confluence at about 6:30.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Ken Vance Volkswagen, featuring the 2013 Volkswagen Passat, a family sedan available in 14 trims, with each model having its own technology features. More at kenvance.com.
Support also comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, offering home mortgage applications online, as well as information about the process, payment amounts, title insurance, mortgage insurance, and more. More at wisconsincu.org.
Spectrum West at 5:47. I'm Al Ross. It's lovely having you along today. In Ladysmith, the Music in the Park's summer season is underway. Next Thursday, June 27th, you'll hear Jumpin' Jehoshaphats. You don't hear that much anymore, do you? Bring a lawn chair to Memorial Park in Ladysmith Thursday evenings at 6, sponsored by the Rusk Area Arts Alliance and the Greater Ladysmith Area Chamber of Commerce. The Shell Lake Arts Center hosts the annual Big Tribute to the Big Bands next Wednesday, the 26th, 7 p.m. in the air-conditioned Daryl Aderman Auditorium. It's free, open to you and me. The Jazz Camp faculty will also play this Sunday at 7 p.m. in the auditorium and Monday evening at the Lakefront Pavilion in Shell Lake. Chill on the Hill for Kids at the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls features Rita Simon and her Native American flutes Tuesday at 11 a.m. Info at cvca.net. Tomorrow evening, it's the exciting percussion ensemble Rimshots at the Northern Lake Center for the Arts, and that is in Amory. Well, the Ludington Guard Band has been around the block, and what a block it is. It has all the quality of a fine, well-preserved antique, and at the same time, the vitality and upbeat perspective of a young person looking out at the horizon, wondering what lies ahead. Dr. Carol Rund is president of the Ludington Guard Band. He's also one of the historians of this longest continuously performing band in Wisconsin. A very interesting history, 125 years is old under any standard, and longevity is sometimes even more difficult when there are lots of folks involved. But your band has achieved a camaraderie that has endured. Is it the heritage of the organization that keeps everyone on the same page, do you think? Or why do you guys play in the sandbox so well?
Well, that's a very good question. It is camaraderie. It's a great part of it. The history certainly makes a difference to a lot of us. It's a lot more fun playing in a band like this that has been around a long time, like we have, than a relatively new band. The music that we play, the scenario that we play in, the band shell, outdoor concerts with large audiences that are very enthusiastic and fun to play to, just make it all come alive and work very well for us.
Let's go way back. You were originally affiliated with a cavalry. The band did start earlier than the birth year that's noted for your band, which was 1888. Tell us about the way back stuff.
Actually, our history goes back to 1869 when a gentleman by the name of Jacob Miller organized a group, and he was the first director of the group, and they had their first season in 1869. They played together as a group until the cavalry unit was established. The cavalry unit was called the Ludington Guard. It was named after the then Honorable Governor Harrison Ludington, who was then governor of Wisconsin. It was a small group, and they played until the cavalry unit was merged with the Wisconsin National Guard, and then the band was disbanded, so to speak. The players were still around, wanted to play, and probably did a little bit, but then they reorganized in 1888, and the organizer was an optometrist and jeweler by the name of Ingraham, and he was the one that suggested the name Ludington Guard Band, going back to the older heritage when the unit was part of the Ludington Guard.
Yeah, and he was the first of what you have named as 12 contemporary directors so far, right?
Correct.
Which is impressive, the fact that there have been only 12 directors in 125 years. Some of them, I noted one was there for 36 years. It's impressive that there have been only 12.
Yes, Mr. Paul Gregg was the longest director with us, and he was, like you say, director for 36 years from 1920 to 1956.
Yeah.
And when the current band shell was built, it was dedicated to his memory, and a nice plaque is on the band shell that commemorates.
Okay,
that.
Yeah, I thought his name sounded more familiar than just having heard about his tenure. Giving his 36 years, that's impressive just in longevity, but he also was at the helm at a time when the ranks were infiltrated by women. It was interesting to read that the band was all male until World War II. Well, you tell us the rest of that story.
Well, up to that point, you had to be 16 and male to get into the band.
Okay.
That was it, and women just were dying to get in, and of course, that just wasn't allowed under the bylaws at the time, and then World War II came along. And a lot of the men in the band were drafted, and so the numbers in the band began to dwindle. The band then agreed to take on women on a temporary basis until the war was over. And, of course, they became part of the band. They were very good players and so enthusiastic. And yeah. When the war was over, the rest is history. It's interesting. I have minutes of the band officers' meeting or the band meetings. They go back almost to the early 1900s, and nowhere in those minutes is that mentioned, which I found very interesting.
Hmm.
I thought that, you know, they would at least say, well, the band agrees to let women in on a temporary basis, but it was never said in those minutes anywhere.
Dr. Carol Rund is with us. He's historian and president of the Ludington Guard Band. They are celebrating their 125th season as the longest continuously performing city band in Wisconsin. How about your personal involvement? How long have you been with the organization?
I joined the band in 1974.
Okay.
I moved to Menominee in 1973 and found out about the band late that summer, and just when their season was about over. And so when the season started next year, I joined.
And you play?
I play tuba.
Well, okay. How many pieces in the band as it stands today?
We number about 70, and we would like to have more, but the band shell stage just will not hold anymore. We're pretty much like sardines up there the way it is when everybody's there. So we're pretty well packed. We just have to limit our instrumentation to 70 people.
Well, I'll bet you Sousa sounds good with 70 people, though.
Bet it does.
That's a good number of people. Do you get approached by alumni of the band? Because, you know, women having been allowed in the band after World War II, any of the original women still around?
There are a few that I meet now and then in the audience that say I used to play in the band years ago. They were before my time in the band.
Sure.
We have a few women who have been in the band longer than I have. Our oldest members are not our oldest member, but he's the member that's been in the band the longest, is a male, and he's been in the band. This is his 51st year. He's younger than I am, and he's a wonderful player. He joined when he was like about 14, and that was younger than they were allowed at the time, but the rule was then and is now that if you're an exceptional player and there's a need and you get a recommendation from your band director, we'll take you younger.
It is imperative, and I know you will agree, that young people take notice and eventually get involved. What steps do you take to be attractive to the future of the band?
Every week at our concert for many, many years, we've had a children's march just before intermission, and that was established by Lynn Pritchard, who was the director back in the 70s and 80s. It was done to keep children quiet, and so you get your chance to come up here and march across the stage if you're good. So they were really good so that they could do this, and it just became a weekly event. So we have hundreds of kids that come up and march across the stage during a special march that we play just for them. And what's happened over the years is that many of these kids eventually join a band at school, and some of them then come and play with us, and they'll tell me, I was a little kid and marched across the stage when I was 3 years old. And once they join us, many of them stay with us for many, many years. Mm-hmm. You know, they just stay here because they love it, and they can hardly wait for the season to start, and are all sad when the season ends.
It's a good way to plant a seed. The Ludington Guard Band of Menominee celebrating its 125th season. Dr. Run, tell us what you have planned for this special year.
Well, we like to think all of our concerts are extra special, and we've already had a number of little things going on. But coming up on July 2nd is our annual patriotic concert. We're going to have a community chorus that will sing patriotic songs along with us, mm-hmm. and that'll be extra special. We don't do that every year. On July 23rd, a very special night, a family from Eau Claire are sponsoring a program that's never happened before. The family have Menominee ties, but now they live there, except that the son teaches strings here at our Menominee High School. UFAL is the name. They wanted to do this because it's our 125th year, and they've always come over for our concerts, and they just wanted to be part of our history, and so they're going to do that. That will be a neat night. And then July 30th is the night that we're going to celebrate our official anniversary. And that night we'll have some presentations by various people. And probably the big thing of that night is that we'll be premiering a piece that we had commissioned for us by a composer in New York. His name is Larry Clark, and the piece is called Legacy of Honor, and it's dedicated to our past band directors whose leadership and dedication basically brought us to where we are today. And then, of course, in the middle of July, we have our annual circus night, which has been going on again since the Lynn Pritchard years. A night that I call our night of controlled chaos. We have a children's costume parade, a pet costume parade. It's more of a show than a concert, but we do all circus-related music. It's a really fun evening, and it attracts a lot of people.
Yeah, I'll bet. And the there is Wilson Park, because you play at the Wilson Park Band Shell, and that is in Menominee, the Ludington Guard Band. It's been a real pleasure learning more about your organization and speaking with you, sir.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you, and I'm glad this word is getting out. We hope a lot of people who are listening come and be a part of our concert scene on Tuesday night.
Hey, folks, I've got one more Spectrum memo here. Sunday, 2 p.m., Peace Lutheran Church in Menominee will be filled with classical music from the Menominee Art Music Society. Hey, next week we'll talk to the mentors on the UW Stout campus in the area of video games, and we'll have other pleasant surprises for our final Friday 5 p.m. broadcast before moving to Thursday mornings. But remember, we'll continue a Friday evening presence on the News and Classical Music Network, and we will get used to it. Thanks to Tiffany Coggins and Dean Kallenbach for contributions to this week's adventure. See you next Friday. Have a wonderful weekend.
Grab a blanket. Bring a picnic and enjoy the music during the 30th season of Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra's Concerts on the Square. Each Wednesday from June 26th through July 31st on the King Street corner of Capitol Square in Madison. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support this summer tradition of outdoor musical performance. For more information, click on WPR.